Cuba says it's going to allow travelers to bring in food, medicine, and hygiene products into the country, at least for the time being. That announcement today comes after thousands of Cubans protested over the weekend, marking the most significant unrest there in decades. They're speaking out against chronic shortages of basic supplies, restrictions on civil liberties, and the communist regime's handling of COVID-19. President Biden reacted to the demonstrations at the White House on Monday.
The United States stands firmly with the people of Cuba as they assert their universal rights, and we call on the government of Cuba to refrain from violence and their attempts to silence the voice of the people of Cuba.
Meanwhile, Cuban Americans in Florida have been urging Biden to do more to bring democracy to the island, with some encouraging the U.S. to lead an international push against the Cuban government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What, if anything, do you want to see in the American response to these protests in Cuba? What questions do you have about the Cuban government, the protests, or U.S. policy toward the country? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Eduardo Gamarra is a professor of political science and founding director of Latino Public Opinion Forum at Florida International University. Eduardo, welcome back to Central Time. Eduardo, are you there?
I sure am.
There we are. We lost you for a sec. I think that was on our end. Thanks for joining us. Eduardo, we don't hear much usually about these kind of larger scale protests in Cuba. How big a development are these protests, Eduardo?
Well, I think if you put this in historical perspective, this is certainly something way beyond anything that Cuba has experienced since the 1959 revolution. There have been, instances of unrest. The most extreme before this was in 1994, during what was called the Cuban Special Period, in which basically there was a large demonstration in the right there by the boardwalk in Havana. And of course, it was fairly easy for the regime to put down that demonstration, even though it did have significant repercussions. But this is very different. This is probably occurring at the time that the Cuban economy is in its worst shape ever, and that's already saying much. It's also occurring at a time when the pandemic in Cuba has reached extremes that really we don't really know about because of the nature of the island, the news coming from the island, but the pandemic appears to have been a very serious situation. And of course, this is also in the context of severe shortages of food, of medicine, and just about anything else. So it's a very significantly different moment from any earlier demonstration. And for some, it's a watershed. I think that we'll have to see, but at the moment it is a very significant, pattern. At least it's not focalized in Havana as normally they have been. This is now spread over the entire country, even in small towns.
And looking at the protests there now, you mentioned shortages of a lot of goods, the impact of COVID-19. As I understand it, in large part, the Cuban economy depends on tourism, which, of course, was shut down all over the world by COVID-19. Is that part of the story here?
Yes. And I mean, this is part of a broader discussion on whether the embargo had an impact on Cuba or not. The reality is that Cuba had many sources of income. It was exporting medical, teams all over Latin America and elsewhere in exchange for revenue. It was, its tourism economy had largely been booming throughout the early part of the 20th century. And one of the things that most people don't really realize is the extent to which Venezuela had helped Cuba by through this program called Petrocaribe, whereby they exported oil to Cuba, and Cuba could then resell on the international market for revenue, and of course also to supply itself with very, very cheap oil. So all of these things that kept the economy alive today are not functioning. And the regime, of course, has also been, you know, affected by some of the measures that the Trump administration took at the very end. One of the most important, and perhaps the one area that's affecting the people of Cuba directly is the remittances. Depending on what economists you talk to, but you know, somewhere between $2 and $3 billion a year are sent to Cuba by Cubans abroad.
We're talking to Eduardo Gamarra from Florida International University, looking at protests in Cuba, possible U.S. responses. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Eduardo, how much of this is related to generational change? The generations that experienced the revolution personally, not many of them with us anymore. The Castro brothers who obtained some of their, I guess, authority, their charisma from their experience there. They're not in charge anymore. How much of this is just the fading memory of the initial revolution?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is. I mean, it's quite interesting to see that, you know, yesterday and the day before, the leadership, the new leadership of Cuba with President Díaz-Canel, paraded the old guard, you know, the three remaining of the old guard, including Raul Castro himself. And, you know, these individuals were paraded sort of to bring back the collective memory of what the Great Revolution was about. But I think there's really a couple of things here that need to be emphasized. First, that Cuba, in the opening that occurred under the Obama administration, began to finally enjoy the benefits of the technological revolution that the rest of us have been enjoying, and particularly internet and access to cell phones. And that, you know, I think we'll know later, of course, how to what extent this is true, but it appears like that has been really a game changer. Because no longer is information just filtered through the propaganda of the state, but now it goes, you know, directly to YouTube, you know, and YouTubers, as they're called in Cuba, are famous worldwide, as are people on Instagram and TikTok and of course on Twitter and so on. So this technological revolution has given voice especially to a very young generation, and a young generation that is, you know, that is rapping and that is, you know, involved it's sort of the artists, in fact, that were at the forefront of this revolt. And they're young people. They're young people who, you know, weren't around, of course, in the late 1950s, and who basically see in the revolution something that is maybe, you know, archaic, maybe even, you know, certainly something that's not meeting their expectations. And so in some measure, the same way that, you know, the generations of young people have done in the past everywhere, you know, they're disenchanted with the regime and they don't have the respect for the institutions of the revolution that their parents and their grandparents did, right? And they've also lost something probably more important. They've lost fear, right? And that is probably what the regime is really, you know, was really surprised that, you know, that just the threat of repression before was enough to put down, you know, any kind of revolt. This weekend was really phenomenal in that sense because of the breadth and scope of this demonstration.
And now here, President Biden in the White House trying to figure out how to respond. Can you talk about the position the Biden administration is in, their range of options?
Yeah, the Biden administration, you know, let me start with a critical point of view. I think they've waited too long to define their policy toward Cuba, right? They essentially said that they would not go back to the Obama-style wide opening, right? But that they would resume people-to-people contacts. And, you know, and in the context that I just described, maybe, you know, this administration, given all of its worldwide and domestic challenges, maybe just put Cuba on the back burner, hoping that nothing would happen. And I think they're in some measure now looking for a way to respond. And the president, I think, has made the correct statement, which was to say we stand with the people of Cuba in this moment of the pandemic and in this moment in which they're being repressed. I think that's the great statement. At the same time, however, Secretary of Homeland Security Mayorca made a statement that was quite controversial, at least down here in Florida. And that is that, the message was, to any Cuban and any Haitian, don't come to the United States because we will send you back home. And so that, that message is really one that, again, has historical roots. It's the fear of another Mariel exodus, as in 1990, or of an exodus as occurred in the mid-1990s. So I think the administration is really right now looking for the correct response. And I think, the administration is going to have to figure this out very quickly and perhaps think about more how does it command an international coalition responding to Cuba rather than defining its policy based on South Florida politics.
We're taking a look at the protests in Cuba and what they mean for America's policies toward the country. Eduardo Gamarra is with us, political science professor and founding director of the Latino Public Opinion Forum at Florida International University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this weekend's protests in Cuba? What do you want to see from President Biden in response? Should the U.S. try to work with international partners to call for change in Cuba, or is what's happening there not our deal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about the protests in Cuba and Miami against the island's communist regime and how the U.S. might respond. Eduardo Gamarra is our guest, professor of political science at Florida International University. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to Florida Senator, Republican and Cuban-American Marco Rubio in an interview on Fox earlier this week, talking about what he wants to see from the Biden administration.
But I think long-term is something we've been pushing for a long time. We're making progress on it when Trump was in office, and that is to provide internet access, satellite internet access, so Cubans don't have to go through the lines and the cables that the Cuban government can shut on and off, but can actually use satellite to communicate to the world and to each other. That'll take some time, but that should be our number one priority right now in terms of what we can do to help the people of Cuba.
That's kind of a longer term, a part of an answer or response here, Eduardo. But what do you think of that idea, trying to provide, you were talking about the impact of internet and cell phones, trying to provide independent access to that sort of thing?
Well, in some measure, it's become a very significant Republican talking point. The governor of Florida has been saying this now, with a great deal of confidence that, that Florida ought to be at the forefront of trying to, in the context that we are right now, providing internet access to Cuba through satellite. Now, I understand that is possible, but it takes a lot more than wishing it to be so, and it involves not just negotiating with the Democrats in Congress. It really involves some kinds of conversations with satellite providers and with companies that are involved in providing internet and so on. And right now in Cuba, the only company that provides the internet access is the Cuban government. So it's easier said than done. And right now at the moment, it's just a talking point. And I think it's a talking point that the Republicans are using to say, look, we really want this, but the Democrats are blocking it. And frankly, as I said, it's just a talking point. It's not anything that's feasible, and certainly nothing that can be done overnight.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Waupaca. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I gave up smoking cigars, but especially when I smoked cigars, I wished we traded with Cuba. But I'm still mystified as to why we can trade with China and borrow money from China, and we trade with Russia. but we won't trade with Cuba 90 miles off our coast. I think it would help the people there if we entered a free trade agreement with them, and the elites in Cuba, they're fine anyway, but I think it would help the common people if we could have free trade.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Eduardo, a long-debated subject, the impact of the embargo, why it's there. Can you? What do you think of Tom's question?
It's a very good question, and frankly, I think, you know, most of my academic colleagues would agree with, you know, the embargo has not had the desired impact in 62 years of regime change. And so, you know, if that was the objective, it hasn't worked. At the same time, however, I think, you know, it's rather disingenuous most of the time to argue that the embargo is in place. The embargo is in place only, you know, if it is an embargo, it has a lot of holes in it, because the U.S. Actually trades with Cuba, you know, and we have a significant amount of trade with Cuba. We also have, you know, as I was talking about, the remittances, about $3 billion a year of remittances. If this was a full embargo, I think, you know, maybe remittances would be the first place, which is actually what Trump did, tried to do. Moreover, there was, you know, there have been extraterritoriality clauses in the embargo, tightened by the Helms-Burton Act of 1997. And extraterritoriality has been very difficult because, you know, we can't force the Spanish not to invest in the tourism sector. We certainly can't prevent the Chinese. We weren't able to prevent the Brazilians from engaging there. We certainly can't prevent the Russians from. So part of the problem with the embargo logic is that it has helped strengthen the extremes on both sides. It's helped the government of Cuba argue that because of the embargo, you know, they are in such a terrible situation, and which, you know, that kind of clouds or gives credence to this idea that it's a U.S. imposition, when in fact, you know, most of their problems are the Soviet Union no longer subsidizes their economy, the Venezuelans no longer do, and they've mismanaged their economy for years. And then on the other side, here in Florida, especially, you know, on some of the more extreme sectors of our community, who argue for the strengthening of the embargo, you know, in fact, you know, their logic is also, in my view, flawed, because we know that even strengthening it is not going to affect a regime change in the short term.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We'll go to Phil now in Kingston. Phil, hello.
Hello, thank you. I was wondering, my family's from Portugal, and my dad, my cousin, used to tell me about the terrible days with the dictatorship from before in the early 70s from President Salazar and his tyrannical rule and so forth. I was wondering if it's possible that America could give aid to Cuba through the stipulation that it would have to be given only to the people, only because I was remembering my family telling me about the Bolivarian coup in 1975, where the people uprose and removed President Salazar and that dictatorship. And also there was a Time magazine article how there was something similar that happened to Poland with Perestroika, and how help with President Reagan behind the scenes, along with even with the Vatican, and helping the Poland get its freedom. So this is, to me, a slight comparison to Portugal, what it was going through.
Phil, thanks a lot. Phil asked a lot there, Eduardo. We just have a minute or so. Can you talk about what you see maybe as a path to overthrowing this government, as Phil says, hopefully bloodlessly?
Well, you know, the unfortunate thing about Cuba is that it has had a very, very repressive regime for now 62 years. And there is no opposition there, you know, that can organize freely and that can in some measure even come together to try to overthrow. They have no access to arms. They have no access to, you know, even as other countries that aren't an island. You know, you might even look at this as kind of an island that, you know, that favors the imposition of this dictatorship. So I don't see the opposition internally capable enough to to organize and to overthrow the regime, right? Or to what we saw this weekend is the closest, I think. The other thing which is important is that, you know, it seems to me that this is the first time that the international community perhaps might be mobilized around something related to forcing the Cuban government to be a little bit more, to open up a little bit. But the Cuban response has really been very Soviet style, right? They've arrested, who knows what the actual number is, but certainly hundreds by now. And so it seems that over the course of the next few weeks, it's going to be more repression, not less repression.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Eduardo Gamarra from Florida International University, looking at the latest news from Cuba.